Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We can just hear what Rush Limbaugh would say. New York Times editor writes book on death of conservatism. Very funny. But Sam Tannenhaus didn't come to his study of conservatism yesterday or in his job at the Times. He's studied it for years, back to its wellsprings. And now, he says, American conservatism is not just off the rails, it is, he claims, dead. That will be news to a lot of conservatives, but we'll hear him out this hour on Point. Sam Tannenhaus on the death of conservatism. You can join the conversation. Is conservatism out of gas or ready to roll? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Sam Tannenhaus. He's the editor of the New York Times Book Review and Week in Review sections. He's author of the well-received Whitaker Chambers, a biography, and is working on an authorized biography of conservative icon William F. Buckley, Jr. His new book is The Death of Conservatism. Sam Tannenhaus, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Delighted to be with you.
Exactly. What has died here, Sam? You make the point that in some ways conservatism is very much alive and kicking today, but your title is right there. It's dead. What's dead?
Well, what's dead is conservatism as a vital constructive force in our politics that's rooted in the principles and traditions conservatives have traditionally upheld and held dear. What this book does, Tom, is really tell a story. It's a narrative book about the rise and ascendancy and triumph of conservatism in the last half century and what seems to me its very sharp decline in the past decade or so. And the way I tell the story is by identifying what seemed to me in these many years of study I've done, two dominant strains on the right. One is a realistic conservatism embodied in presidents like Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon in some ways, Ronald Reagan in some ways, and this always surprises people, Bill Clinton in some ways. That is a realistic Burkean conservatism. Contrary to that, in fact, fighting an almost continual battle with it is what I call a revanchist conservatism, which is really a form of radicalism. It is movement conservatism as we're familiar with it today. This is the politics of Newt Gingrich, of Rush Limbaugh. It's based on a kind of distrust verging on enmity toward political and cultural institutions. And to me, it seemed as I read more and more and thought more and more about all of this that the great founders of modern conservatism, Edmund Burke in England in the 1790s, and the great British statesman Benjamin Disraeli in the mid-19th century would not have considered this conservative at all because they thought that the function, the office of conservatism was to preserve the great values in the society, that is, to oppose all ideologies, whether of the left or of the right, because ideological thinking, ideological politics are radical, not conservative.
Give us some meat on those bones then, Sam, some compare and contrast these two in sort of in the real world, in action of how you see these two strands of conservatism playing out.
Well, let me give you an example from our recent history. I think and argue in the book that the last true Burkean conservative president was Bill Clinton. Here's why. Clinton was elected in 1992 in a period that was largely conservative. He followed Ronald Reagan, who'd been a popular and admired and in many ways successful president. Clinton came into office as a kind of standard issue liberal Democrat, a great admirer of John F. Kennedy's New Frontier and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. And Clinton, like President Obama more recently, was worried about an economic downturn, not as severe as the one we've seen, but one that had caused a recession. And in fact, that helped him get elected. So shortly after taking office, Bill Clinton proposed what today seems an almost comically modest stimulus proposal. It was $19.5 billion.
Piddling.
That is 1/40th, yes, the size of what President Obama initiated and put through Congress. And the Republican Senate leader, Bob Dole, did something almost unprecedented in our political history. He used the Senate filibuster because Clinton had majorities in the House and Senate almost identical to what the Democrats have today. Clinton's victory, by the way, was more substantial than many saw acknowledged at the time or since. And Bob Dole used the filibuster four times to kill that stimulus package and reduce it to $4 billion, a bare-bones employment insurance program. Now, students of our legislative history, including one Alan Ehrenholt, the editor of Governing Magazine, a nonpartisan publication, said that using the filibuster to prevent a president from enacting his chosen legislative agenda broke with the tradition of our politics. That is to say, it used the forces of ideology to stop a popularly elected president. But here's where the turn comes. The Republicans were actually right. We didn't need a stimulus then. The economy recovered on its own. So what did Bill Clinton do? He actually altered his course in office. He adjusted to the changing political conditions of the time, became a great supporter of the free market, for better or worse. You know, we might look at it differently today. In his 8 years, a remarkable thing happened. Unemployment decreased every single year, something we had not seen before or since. And Clinton then negotiated with a Republican Congress to, quote, end welfare as we know it, unquote. So what Bill Clinton did was to follow the classic prescription set forth by Edmund Burke in 1790, which is that he used government to conserve, that is, to preserve the free market politics his predecessor had successfully presented to the public, but also to correct. That is to say, he used government when he could to control those excesses. He adjusted to the prevailing politics, the temper of his times. That is classical conservatism. What we see now with contemporary Republicans, with the last Republican president, George Bush, who had smaller majorities than Bill Clinton and who had not even won a plurality of the vote, was instantly to use all the forces at his disposal to enact a very ideological political agenda, which the public was uncertain about, but he had the forces to enact. That is not a conservative politics. It's an ideological politics. And that's the difference between revanchism on the one hand, which is a politics that seeks to restore and recover some earlier version or vision of what America should be, as opposed to the more moderate and negotiating, maneuvering politics that Bill Clinton embraced.
But Sam, who's to say what's the legitimate conservatism here? I mean, there clearly are some conservatives who do want to go back. They even want to go back pre-New Deal. And we saw a lot of that push, even very explicit in recent years. So who's to say that you're right and Rush and Sarah Palin and, I don't know, Newt Gingrich are wrong?
Oh, they may very well be right. What they're not doing in any way is adhering to the precepts of conservatism as it was initially envisioned. Let me give you an example of another president who I think was classically conservative. This is Dwight Eisenhower, whose course mirrored Bill Clinton's. Eisenhower followed a period in which the Democrats had occupied the White House for 20 years. The only presidents America knew throughout the 1930s and 40s were Democrats, Franklin D. Roosevelt and then Harry Truman. And Eisenhower took office realizing that the great program Roosevelt had devised, the New Deal, had become so embedded in the consciousness of the public and also in the way government itself worked, the enlargement of federal bureaucracies, the many proliferating agencies, the safety net created by the government for the indigent, and Social Security, and then later, of course, would become Medicare. Dwight Eisenhower understood that this had actually become the normative politics Americans accepted and were happy with. So his job as a Republican was not to roll it back, not to undo it. Again, that would have been a kind of counter-revolution, a kind of radicalism. So instead, he did his best to moderate the New Deal.
The new criterion writes, Sam, that you want a kind of a tame conservatism. They said writers like Tannenhaus want to see a conservative movement that accommodates rather than opposes liberalism. That's essentially what you're saying Eisenhower did.
Yes, that's right. The problem with that analysis is that it never really presents what the ideal conservatism is, except to identify itself through what I call a politics of enmity. That is opposition both to government, to the president when it's a Democratic president. If it's a Republican president, then conservatives seem to become what we call conservatives, right-wing Republicans then become supporters of a kind of imperial presidency. They are very skeptical of all the government agencies we have and want to dismantle them as much as we can. And then they really declare a kind of culture war on the New York Times, where I work, on lawyers, on doctors, on professors, on many of the institutions that actually form the bedrock of our society. And so they may be correct to do this, and I know they're impassioned when they do it, but they never really explain what's conservative about that, because it is a politics of revanchism, of restoration, just as you said. In fact, the language that hardline Republicans are using against Barack Obama, the epithets they use, socialist, fascist, are precisely the ones, I describe this in the book, not even similar, precisely the ones Herbert Hoover used against Franklin Roosevelt.
Sam Tannenhaus, stand by. We've got to take a short break right here. The new book is The Death of Conservatism. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Sam Tannenhaus, a top editor at the New York Times, about his new book, The Death of Conservatism. You hear his argument that it's getting nihilistic, that it's lost its conservationist kind of impulse, that it's getting down dirty, nasty. We're going to hear in just a moment from John Fund of the Wall Street Journal. But first, Craig in Buffalo, you're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. Very interesting. I'm glad you wrote the book, sir.
Well, nice hearing from you.
I'm glad you wrote the book, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear, Craig. What do you think is going on, Craig?
Well, as a lifelong conservative, I can understand what the gentleman's talking about. Conservatism of Bill Clinton and Eisenhower. It's nothing like Sarah Palin or Sean Hannity or anything like that. I've been a conservative all my life. I just voted for Obama this year, much to the consternation of my family. But I can't take the obstructionism that has become the conservative movement nowadays. There's a lot of misinformation being given out by these people.
Craig, you're breaking up on us a little bit, but I appreciate your call. I think we've got the main gist of it. Let me get one more right here from Nashville. And Carl. Carl, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Carl. Hi, you're on.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking to you. I've seen you before on television shows promoting your book. It seemed like to be a great book. And I like to echo what that other gentleman said from another perspective. When I was growing up, I fancied myself as a conservative, because who wouldn't want those type of values? Family, conservative with your money, smaller government. Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't want those type of things? But ever since the rise of Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, and those guys, it's a nastiness to it now, and they have let themselves be defined, in particular in black communities. When you say conservatives, the first thing come to your mind is racist. And this is a bad thing, because conservatism isn't a bad thing, but I believe they let that title be hijacked and turned into something that it isn't. So We'll see what can be done about that.
Sounds like you're off the bandwagon, Carl, but thank you for calling, but off it with regret. Sam, stand by for a moment here. I want to mix it up a bit with John Fund, editorial page columnist for The Wall Street Journal, author of Stealing Elections. He joins us from New York City. John Fund, thanks very much for being here. You get the basic gist of Sam Tannenhaus's thesis. What do you say to it, John?
Well, I think Sam is a very careful scholar, and there's much in his book to commend. I would simply point out, though, that we live in a media age, and the perceptions of who represents various ideologies or points of view has changed dramatically. I watched conservatives try to pretend that liberalism was defined during the Bush years by Keith Olbermann and Chris Matthews and various people who were shouting on television shows during those years. Now, I think some people have decided to define conservatism by people like Rush Limbaugh and people like Sarah Palin, who's now resigned from politics and is heading for a media career. And I have to tell you, the Democrats nominated John Kerry, distinguished senator. They nominated Barack Obama. Those ultimately were the people who carried the banner of liberalism. I can guarantee you that in 2012, the Republicans are not going to nominate either Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Sarah Palin to carry the banner of conservatism. So I think we sometimes confuse people who are highly visible and have lots of name ID from the people who are actually going to be making the programmatic case for an alternative to President Obama's policies.
Interesting. Sam Tannenhaus, you're pointing at the wrong parade, John says.
Hi, John. John and I have known each other a long time. Oh, no, he's absolutely right, what John says. This book is not about Rush Limbaugh and Sarah Palin.
Well, it sure, I mean, there's a lot about them in here.
No.
I look at the index. I looked at the index. It's full.
There is no index.
No,
there
but
is
I mean, no index I'm looking at the page, Sam.
I'm looking at the book itself. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, they're right here in the first few pages. You're calling them out as exemplars of the problem you're talking about.
Yeah, of course. They are exemplars, but that's not what this book deals with. Mm. I don't know if either one of you has really looked at it.
Pretty deep.
This is a history of the rise of conservatism. The main chapters in this book begin in 1932 and end in 2008. And it and the figures it emphasizes are people like Whitaker Chambers, William F. Buckley, James Burnham, Wilmore Kendall. These are the philosophers of modern conservatism. The argument I'm making is that it's intellectuals of that caliber that we don't see on the right. Now, we don't see them on the left either. But this isn't a book about the left. It's a book about the history of the right, which I've studied for a very long time.
But the revanchists you're calling out are precisely Rush and Sarah and Newt Gingrich and so on.
Well, but now Newt Gingrich is different. Now you're talking about the Speaker of the House. When John says, or you say, that on the one hand we're presenting John Kerry and Barack Obama, and then we're talking about Rush Limbaugh and Sarah Palin, that's not true. I look at all of our recent elections. There's a long treatment. Well, it's a short book, but there's an in-depth treatment of the Reagan years, of the Nixon years. And what this book does is to identify how the dominant figures in modern conservatism actually oscillated between the two poles of what I call revanchism on the one hand and realism on the other, and how the great thinkers did that too. One of the narratives this book enfolds is Bill Buckley's maturity as a political writer and thinker. He began as quite a flame-throwing McCarthyite and emerged as the great Burkean commentator in our politics during a period of upheaval in the late 1960s.
What do you say, John?
Well, the great Burkean conservative, William F. Buckley, wrote a book called Up From Liberalism, full of bitter criticism of someone that Sam calls a conservative president, Dwight Eisenhower. He opposed Richard Nixon's nomination for president in 1972 when he was running for re-election, and he would be rolling over in his grave as we speak to hear Bill Clinton, who proposed one of the largest tax increases in American history in 1993 and the largest takeover of health care until President Obama. He would have rolled over in his grave if he'd heard Sam describe Bill Clinton as a conservative. I met William F. Buckley. He did not think Bill Clinton was a conservative.
But
John, I didn't just meet Bill Buckley. I spent many, many days and evenings with him over the course of, you know, the better part of two decades.
And he thought Bill Clinton was a conservative.
No, first of all, you're misrepresenting and I'm not surprised because I'm hearing this consistently. If you bring my argument, if you bring up Up From Liberalism, that's a book Bill Buckley wrote in 1959. That's the very young Bill Buckley. That's not the Bill Buckley who in 1967, when Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, it's time for liberals to take responsibility for the failures of the Great Society. And by the way, the pivotal chapter in this narrative is about the failure of liberalism in the 1960s and how conservatives recognized that failure, actually formed bridges. Bill Buckley formed a bridge with the liberal Democrat Daniel Patrick Moynihan to create what Moynihan called, drawing explicitly on Edmund Burke, the politics of stability. Look, let me give you another example from the book. This is and John is right to say Bill Buckley remained a very principled conservative. Of course he would disagree with my analysis of Clinton as a conservative. But that's not really the argument here. The argument is how did Bill Buckley represent and present conservative ideas, language, and values to the broader public? Watch Firing Line when Bill Buckley is arguing with Noam Chomsky, and it is done at such a level of politeness compared to what we see today. It almost looks like a Monty Python sketch.
John,
but here's the point I want to make, though. No. In 1968, when Lyndon Johnson was strongly considering running again, a re-election campaign, he was almost defeated in the New Hampshire primary by the left-wing Democrat Eugene McCarthy, who challenged him so strongly in that primary that LBJ decided not to seek re-election. This should have been a moment for Bill Buckley to crow, to triumph in the failure of the Democratic Party. But, John, you know he didn't do that. You saw the columns I quote in the book. Instead, he said, if a carload of college students, carloads of them, can cross over the border from Massachusetts to New Hampshire to take down a president within their own party, any conservative has to take pause and wonder about the state of our democracy.
John Fund, right?
Filibuster is very interesting, but can I just say one thing before the second?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Sorry, John. Your turn.
Barely. Look, I think Sam's book is worthy. I think it should be read. But just remember, we've seen books come and go that make interesting predictions, and I think that Sam perhaps shouldn't have allowed his book to be called The Death of Conservatism, because political cycles and intellectual cycles move very quickly. In 1969, Kevin Phillips wrote The Emerging Republican Majority. A few years later, Richard Nixon violated his constitutional oath. We had Watergate. The Republican Party almost died. In 2003, John Judis and others wrote The Emerging Democratic Majority, just a couple of years before President Bush won re-election and the Republicans won 55 Senate seats. In 2007, we had Tom Hamburger of the Los Angeles Times who wrote One Party Country about how the Republican Party was going to dominate American politics. I suspect that 6 months ago, when President Obama was in his honeymoon period, very few people would think that his approval rating on health care would be down to 42%. Democrats would be double digits for the governorships of Virginia and New Jersey. Political cycles come and go. I think Sam makes a very valuable book. I think he's just overselling the thesis. I think conservatism needs intellectual renewal, especially. I think it needs new ideas, just as liberalism did. But I don't think we should write premature epitaphs.
Can you, John, just to get to Sam's thesis, do you believe that you can be a movement conservative, an ideological conservative, and a constructive Burkean conservative? Sam kind of suggests to me anyway, no. What do you say?
Conservatism is two strains. It is traditionalism and it is libertarianism. Ronald Reagan himself said that. And I think those strains are often in conflict. But if you accept Sam's thesis, it's a sort of Brezhnev doctrine. Brezhnev, the Soviet leader, said all countries are socialist and eventually all capitalist countries will be socialist. If you accept Burkean conservatism on Sam's terms, liberalism will eventually achieve all of its goals on the installment plan because conservatism must slowly cede ground to it. And I think that there's a lot of conservatives that do have a positive vision, and libertarians as well, who have a positive vision of a entrepreneurial capitalist country that is also a tolerant and diverse nation. So I think that he's right about a large part of the conservative movement, but the conservative movement is bigger than the movement he describes.
Sam, I'll bring that to you. Let me get a call from Christine in Norfolk, Virginia. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to address from a moderate perspective that I do feel I have an open mind and I'm interested in hearing both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel that I stand for one party or the other, but issues at hand. And I feel that I don't understand the issues of the right side being associated with conservatism. I don't understand what conservatism means, as I'm trying to keep an open mind, because the issues seem to be muddled with anger and confusion and scare tactics. When I've tried many times to reach out to people with opposing views to meet in the middle somewhere, and there doesn't seem to be a bottom line about the issues from a conservative standpoint. And I would like to see a strong figure that represents conservatism to speak with about the issues at hand. But the argument is...
You're not hearing it. Yeah.
No, I don't understand. I don't know what I'm even debating with.
Christine, we've got it. Let me bring that. I think we've got it. Let me bring it to Sam. Sam, Christine's got an open mind, but she hears
yes.
anger and scare tactics. How do you interpret?
Well, Christine points to something that is actually contained in what John said. So let me try to wrap these two together, John Fund. First of all, I think he's quite mistaken about Nixon. Actually, what happened was the Republicans, after Nixon won in 1968, they won again in 1972 with precisely the huge majority Kevin Phillips predicted. In other words, he said the alienated whites who had voted for George Wallace, who was a spoiler in 68, would migrate to the Republican Party, which is precisely what it did. It is now a southernized party. As we know, there's not a single member of the House of Representatives from the Northeast. Republicans then won again in 80, 84, and 88. The only election they lost in 1976 came after the unparalleled crimes of Watergate, and even then, they lost by a single state. That was a Republican era, and this is what gets me to Christine's point. In fact, the cycles John talks about are not validated by history. In the book, I cite a very important thesis early on. It's interesting to me. This is in the first few pages of the book, Tom. I don't hear you and John mention it. That's the theory of the political solar system devised by the great political journalist Samuel Lubell.
One party dominates.
And, yes, that what we have is, he called, a sun party and a moon party. If you look at history, really since the Civil War, one party or the other has really set the tone and the agenda for some 30 to 36 years, sometimes longer. And what happens when this occurs is that the great debates occur within that single party, while the other party sort of rotates, revolves in its marginal orbit. So in the 1980s, for instance, the Sun Party was Ronald Reagan's Republican Party. So the great issues, how to end the Cold War, how to revive the economy, how to restore American ideals, were all really solved or at least addressed by Republicans. Now, look at where we are today. Where is the healthcare debate going to be decided? By the Democratic Party. The Republicans have essentially vacated the field. They did this with the stimulus package, too. Mm. They did the same thing they did in the 1930s and 40s. There was tremendous opposition in Congress then, too. The hero of the right was Robert Taft. Four times sought the presidential nomination and thought by the party faithful that he was owed it.
Sam, right? Hold the thought. John Fund, our time ticks. What do you say to Christine, who's open, but here's anger, not scare tactics from the American conservatives today. Why do you think she has that impression, John?
Well, I think that the people who are frustrated often engage in scare tactics on both sides of the political spectrum, and I welcome Sam writing a book about the deficiencies of the left as well, because I think that would be a good balancing act. I do believe that about 80% of the American people are not ideological. I think that's where Sam and I agree. The vast number of the American people are centrists. They want government that works for them. Not big government, not small government, but government that works for them. And I believe that the Obama administration is making some of the same mistakes that some administrations in the past, including Republican ones, have made, which is overreaching, imagining that it has an ideological mandate. And that's why I think you're seeing President Obama's approval numbers tumbling so much. You'll get a bounce from last night's excellent speech. Mm. But there's a reason why liberalism is also in crisis, because they have foreseen the weakness in conservatism that Sam properly describes, and they've calculated that they can now get everything they want by overreaching, like Icarus moving too close to the sun. Their wings will melt, and the political cycles that we both have described, although we may disagree in details, will begin again, because liberalism would be much better to listen to centrists like your caller than to try to overreach as they're currently doing with Obama's program.
John Fund, editorial page columnist with The Wall Street Journal. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Sam Tannenhaus, a top editor at The New York Times, about his new book, The Death of Conservatism. He wrote a very well-received biography of Whitaker Chambers, prominent conservative figure, currently working on a biography of William F. Buckley, Jr., a man and thinker he knows well. Sam, I raised the word nihilism from the early pages of your book. You talk a fair bit about what you see as destructive tendencies, nihilistic tendencies. Link those back to your thesis. If that's the case, where does that come from?
Well, where it comes from is the origins of the modern right. Again, this book describes a kind of dialogue, or not to sound like a Marxist, a dialectic between the two modes of conservatism. And one of the first great, perhaps the most influential modern conservative thinker was a former leftist, as many of the first conservatives were, James Burnham, who had been the principal advisor and theorist to Trotsky in the United States, a brilliant professor of philosophy who wrote a classic book, The Managerial Revolution, published in 1941, which influenced George Orwell's 1984. And what Burnham did was to say, we are looking at societies through an imperfect lens, that we should understand them not as being either totalitarian or democratic, but as massive technological bureaucracies. And those who control them are not our elected leaders. They are what Barry Goldwater later called the gnomes of Washington. They're the mandarins, the bureaucrats, the policymakers who write the policies and programs that government then enacts. And what this thesis did, and it drew on much thinking and analysis by Burnham, what it did was to make us look at politics in a different way, particularly conservatives, to see it in its crudest terms, almost as a kind of conspiracy, as a class warfare being waged secretly by those amassing power below the radar in Washington. This is still the dominant analysis that comes out not so much from the Rush Limbaughs as the leading thinkers on the right, that the leaders of agencies, the policymakers, are our enemies. They have secret agendas they want to impose on us, that the health care bill is really a kind of Trojan horse that wants to sneak in all these dangerous remedies to weaken us and to rob us of our liberties. This is exactly what we've been hearing all summer. I attended an event in Washington, I can't identify it, at which a major Republican aspirant, someone who's running for governor of a major state, said, if Barack Obama wants to come to my state and take away our guns, I will meet him at the state line. This was said in a room of 140 movement conservatives, including members of Congress. This was accepted as noble discourse. He was cheered for this. There were documents circulating in that room that asked why the media isn't looking more closely at the phony birth certificate Barack Obama has foisted on us. These are ideas that are being repudiated by very, very few intellectuals on the right, let alone the Glenn Becks who actually foster them and endorse them. This is the state conservatism is in today. And I think back to the caller, Christine, who said, why isn't there someone on the other side she can talk to? The answer is there is no one. Oh, the politicians we've talked about, Gingrich, Sarah Palin, none of them is a true leader, of even a recognized leader at that point within the Republican Party itself. This is the crisis facing the right. They don't have the leaders because they don't have the intellectuals. You know, I mentioned before I had many, countless conversations with William F. Buckley, the great Bill Buckley. And at one point I said to him, how did you find Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan? How did you find these gifted tribunes for an ideology? And he said, I didn't go to them. They came to me. meaning his great magazine, National Review, founded in 1955, had become a storehouse of real ideas and arguments. They presented a counter vision of what America might look like in terms that had to be taken seriously by liberals.
You know,
this is what we lack today.
It wasn't that long ago that the sort of conventional wisdom was the other way around, that conservatives were, you know, driving the agenda of the country. You hear John Fund's critique. He says what you want, Sam, is conservatives who just applaud liberals, who just kind of are handmaidens to a long liberal progressive arc of destiny.
Do we think, does John think, now he disputes my interpretation of Bill Clinton as really the Eisenhower of our period, although that's how many liberals and much of the left saw him as a kind of traitor to liberalism. Mm-hmm. Does he really think that Clinton became a handmaiden to the destruction of his own party? No. What he did was to compromise with the other side. There's a very interesting piece of political history that I'm going to go through very quickly. What we are now so accustomed to is what callers have described as the obstructionism of a Republican Congress with a Democratic president. That began, as I said, during the New Deal, continued through the 1940s. It really culminated in the McCarthy hearings, which McCarthy attacked first Harry Truman and then Dwight Eisenhower, his own elected president. In the 1950s, though, when Eisenhower was a popular president, the Senate was dominated and the House by two Texans. Lyndon Johnson was the great Senate Majority Leader, and Sam Rayburn was the Speaker of the House. And they devised what seemed a radical model for legislation. They decided they would, quote, help the president govern, unquote. So Democrats in Congress became the allies of a Republican president, kind of what happened again with Bill Clinton. They formed alliances. They operated out of a politics of consensus. Another point being lost here, which is spelled out very clearly in the opening pages of my book, is that there are two ways of looking at politics. One as a politics of consensus, a Latin term. It's come the same word as census, taking the poll, counting the heads, and finding where most of them come together. And that's how you forge politics and policy. It's how Eisenhower did it. It's how Nixon did it for quite a while, and Reagan did it, and how Clinton did it. Then there is the politics of orthodoxy, or what some conservatives call right reason, where you stick so closely to your principles that you will sacrifice the public good in order to further them. And that's when what we call conservatism becomes profoundly unconservative, because it's not asking what can be done to keep a harmonious society as much in sync as possible, but only how to achieve the ends, how to put the check marks on our agenda list. And this is what's happened with all our politics. And John Fund is quite right when he says this was a problem on the left. That's why a chapter of the book is about the failure of an overreaching president, Lyndon Johnson, and his policymakers. That is actually a model that encapsulates what might well happen to Barack Obama if he lets his agenda and his view of politics be dominated by the left wing in his own party. But he may very well overreach.
Interestingly, you say, though, that Barack Obama is a president who seems more thoroughly steeped in the Burkean principles of conservation and correction than any significant thinker or political figure on the right today. Obama, do you see him as the country's new conservative? Is that what conservatism means to you?
He's not the new conservative. What I also say in the book, he's politically liberal, but conservative by temperament. And we forget how much of our politics is about temperament. Look, Ronald Reagan in his early career denounced Social Security, Medicare, and the graduated income tax, which he said had been invented by Karl Marx. All right? Now, actually, there was a germ of truth to the last assertion. It's in the Communist Manifesto. By the time he was running for office in 1980, he was promising the public he wouldn't touch Medicare and he wouldn't touch Social Security. Then he did change the tax structure. But as soon as the government got too big and it grew bigger under him than under any of his predecessors, he started raising taxes again. That's realistic politics. What I say, Obama seems to understand, and remember, we're very early in his presidency. We don't know where it will lead. What he seems to understand is what Hannah Arendt once described as the true office of the statesman, which is to listen. not listen just in the sense that you don't talk while the other guy does, but rather you put yourself in the minds of those who differ with you. You try to understand their vocabulary. One reason I wrote this book was I was so struck by the remarkable speech Obama gave in Philadelphia on race during the campaign, not because he made the eloquent defense of Jeremiah Wright and the concerns and fears of African Americans. It was what he said about white people that was so impressive. I remember he talked about how there are many white Americans who are not the legatees of Jim Crow or slavery and resent being told that they are. And I thought, this man has read his Daniel Patrick Moynihan. That was the basis of Moynihan's own political revolution, was when he decided that the effort to create so many social programs to help the disenfranchised was alienating much of the rest of the working class. Obama had mastered that language and idiom. And a lot of our politics, as opposed to policy, set policy aside for a second, a lot of our politics, what Richard Hofstadter described as early as 1954, as the continual theater of our politics, driven by mass media, which is the reason that Beck and Limbaugh spring to mind when people talk about this, is about the language we use, the way we cast our arguments, and the vocabulary we create to convey the ideas we have. The great masters of modern conservative thought, the Whitaker Chamberses, the William Buckleys, the James Burnhams, the Irving Kristols, and Patrick Moynihans saw they had to write in a way that liberals and conservatives both could gain something from. That notion of an exalted language rooted in the values of civil society, in Burke's great terms, has totally disappeared on the right.
Let's listen to Andy in Lansing, Michigan. Andy, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm wondering why the conservatives, picking up on what was just said, haven't picked up on the language of the family and religion and the conservative philosophy that most people live their families by, you know, watching their purses, keeping their money, protecting their children for health and safety, planning to get a family doctor, whatever the outgrowth of state and national political philosophy, it seems to spring from more local, more family-oriented institutions.
But Andy, let me just ask you, I mean, faith and family have been, at least rhetorically, right at the center of an awful lot of conservative talk for a long time now, haven't they?
It doesn't seem to be a keynote. They seem to start with the national and the state. And, you know, Russell Kirk, along with Buckley and these other people, seem to focus more on the local institutions, fidelity to home and the family and values of their institutions. And out of that would grow their philosophy of how the state officials should apply. I mean, I think Burke said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think that's part of the principle that your speaker has been saying, that Obama might succumb to that same temptation.
Make it local, make it real, faith and family. But Sam, faith and family have sure been up in the billboards of an awful lot of conservative conventions.
Yeah, first of all, just because I'm an editor and I can't restrain myself, it was Lord Acton who said power corrupts and absolute. Just, you know, so there's not confusion. I think the caller makes a tremendously valid point. And Russell Kirk is another figure only touched on in my book, and I wish there had been room to do more with him. He's absolutely right. If you look at the origins, the first great statesman in modern conservatism, in my analysis, was the great Benjamin Disraeli, who was a Tory, who was concerned about what seemed to be the ravages of the revolution of his time, which was the Industrial Revolution. And what it had done was to create a new class of entrepreneurs who were tremendously wealthy and who had destabilized the society and were threatening, he thought, not only to destroy its traditional hierarchy, which maybe deserved to be destroyed, but who were actually exploiting the poor in their workhouses. This is what Dickens wrote about. Dickens was contemporary of a Disraeli. And so Disraeli then saw that what government should do is to protect the poor. That would reinforce the people, the ordinary person's belief in the value not of government but of his own society, that something that feudal aristocrats once did would now be done by the government. And a modern American president actually tried to do this. Ready for the drumbeat? It was Richard Nixon. Nixon came into office in 1969 and, fascinated by the arguments put forth by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, created an ad hoc position for him in the cabinet. And they came up with a remarkably ambitious plan to rescue the poor. And what they were going to do was actually follow, on the one hand, the precepts of a movement conservative, their favorite economist, Milton Friedman. But on the other, follow what Chambers called Disraeli's politics of maneuver. So what were they going to do? Instead of creating a mass of federal programs that would help people with enlarged welfare policies, they would actually give money to people. It's what later became the negative income tax. They would actually give money to people, including the working poor, to keep families together. And it would be administered locally and through the states. And that way you would get the government out of it. The government would be the bank. And yet it would happen on a local level.
Sam, we've got 1 minute. Do you see a path back to that? Or is the conservative idol that you're describing here just gone, just left behind by the evolution of the movement?
I don't think it's gone. The problem is this is the crisis facing the right. We do not see the intellectual or political leaders who can galvanize these ideas. These are not new ideas. They're the bedrock of modern conservatism and the Republican Party at its greatest time. There must be leaders and thinkers and writers who can return to these ideas, end the culture wars, stop stockpiling ammunition for the next election cycle, actually look at what the country needs. There are a few. There are some in the Senate. Ron Wyden, who's a Democrat, but who has come up with an alternative proposal for health care, which President Obama should look at more closely. John McCain gave President Obama one piece of his health care plan. There are some people there. They have to become the dominant voices. I think they can, but it may be that a period of marginalization, a period as the Moon Party, circling in their lonely orbit, may give them the time to re-examine, rethink, and come back to the table and the game.
Of course, John McCain also gave us Sarah Palin. Sam Tannenhaus' new book is The Death of Conservatism. He joined us today from New York City. Sam, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.